Okay, if you have not already, you might get your Bibles out and go to Acts chapter 27. We're going to be looking at this chapter this morning. If you're just coming in, there are some handouts there on the back table to help you follow along with the class this morning. This is a very interesting chapter. It's a fun chapter to study. When you get to Acts chapter 27, you are obviously nearing the end of the book of Acts, but there is so much more to the history of the church and the history of the life of Paul than just what we have in these 28 chapters. But there's only 28 chapters in this book. What we're going to do is study chapter 27 today. Next week, Troy Spradlin will be here to give a mission report. The Sunday after that, Kyle Butt will be here for our youth weekend. And so we'll get to chapter 28 on second Sunday of May, on Mother's Day. And then we have our Coming Home Sunday, the Sunday after that, and so we'll have only one class to wrap everything up at the end of May. So just to give you an idea of the direction that we're going. When you get to Acts chapter 27, Paul has appealed to go before Caesar. He was not getting any kind of fair treatment, obviously, by those that he was standing before. None of his judges were willing to free him, as the evidence would have demanded. And so they continued to delay and drag their feet until finally Paul said, fine, I appeal to Caesar. And it's interesting, you know, obviously that in some cases would be a last resort kind of thing. You know, who wants to go stand before Nero? I'm sure that list of people who wanted to do that was rather short, who would want to go stand before Nero, but you think about the fact that because Paul appealed to Caesar, the gospel was proclaimed in the presence of all of these leading dignitaries and all of these governors, and ultimately even before the emperor himself. How could that have happened otherwise? How could that possibly have happened otherwise? When you get to Philippians chapter 1, when you read the book of Philippians, Paul is in prison in Rome when he writes the book of Philippians, and he says that the gospel has been spread to the whole palace guard. You know, when Paul gets to prison in Rome, he doesn't just sit there and be bored out of his mind. He's still preaching the gospel. And while he's in the prison in Rome, he's still proclaiming it to, he says, the whole palace guard has heard the gospel even at that point, and Nero would have that opportunity as well. You get to chapter 27, Paul is being transported from Caesarea, where he was imprisoned for 2 years. Sometimes we forget that because it's only mentioned in the last verse of chapter 24 that he was imprisoned there for 2 years, and we don't have any details of that in Scripture, and so it's easy to skip over and see that 2 years transpired there. He appeared on trial before Festus, the governor, and then we read last week in chapter 26 where he was before the Jewish king, Agrippa. At the end of chapter 26, Agrippa had said, you know, if he hadn't appealed to Caesar, he probably would have been set free. But because he's appealed to Caesar, he's going to be transported to Rome. It's interesting that God gives us an entire chapter about a boat ride. He gives us an entire chapter about transporting Paul from Caesarea to Italy. Why do we have that? We don't have a sermon necessarily, although we have a couple of speeches and comments that Paul makes in this chapter. We don't have a sermon that he's preaching about Jesus. We don't read about anybody being baptized. You know, we don't read about anybody being converted. Why do we have 44 verses? Why do we have 44 verses to tell us about getting Paul from point A to point B, from Caesarea to Italy? And I've given you some possibilities on your handout there on Roman numeral number A, letter 2 there, or number 2. Just some possibilities. We don't know exactly why God would do this. You know, the inspiration process and the recording of Scripture at that time was very intricate and very time-consuming, but perhaps God wanted us to continue to see Paul as a leading figure. He's a prisoner, and yet on this voyage, he takes a leading role. How is that possible? How does a prisoner become a dominant character on this occasion? Perhaps it's again for us to see the providence of God at work throughout this chapter. And then perhaps, as you have on your handout, perhaps it is to allow some of the skeptics who don't believe that the Bible is really from God or that the men who wrote the Bible had a clue what they were doing. Perhaps these 44 verses were given so that the skeptics who would try to tear this book apart and say, well, here's Luke, he doesn't know what he's talking about, would actually get into this chapter and find that every little detail that is mentioned has been proven to be true. It's interesting to go and research individuals who have tried to come, especially to the book of Acts, and some of them even to chapter 27, some expert seamen who say, well, you know, Luke was a doctor. What does a doctor know about boats? What does he know about ships? What does he know about anything about the sea? And so they thought, you know, here's a guy, he surely doesn't know what he's saying. And though they've come to the chapter and they've tried to pick what he said apart, well, maybe he doesn't. And what they figured out is every detail that Luke gives in this chapter is precisely accurate. He uses terminology. He uses the seagoing terminology that, how would he know that? And he uses it exactly the way that it should be used. And so we'll try to point some of that out as we go through this, but the only answer to how that could happen is inspiration. How would Luke have any idea what to call things and how to accurately call certain things? And so we get to this chapter, and it's interesting, the story that is here in this chapter. It was decided, chapter 27, verse 1, when it was decided that we should sail to Italy. Who's we? Who's we? Who's writing this book? Luke is writing this book. This is the third time in this book, it's the third section where we've come across these first person plural pronouns. Luke is now with Paul again. We don't know when he joined him, but when he uses the first person plural pronoun, we and us, Luke is now with Paul. Perhaps he had been with Paul all of this time while he was in Jerusalem and Caesarea. We're not told. But Paul is going to have, as you have on your handouts, he's got a couple friends who are going to travel with him on this voyage. One of them is Luke, and we don't know that because his name is there, but we know it because he uses that first-person plural pronoun to include himself. And so Paul is there. He has his friend Luke. Down in verse 2, he has his friend Aristarchus, who had come with him from Thessalonica. It's interesting that Aristarchus is still with him. Aristarchus is not one of these names we know very well. But Aristarchus had been with Paul on his third missionary journey. You remember on his third missionary journey, he went through Ephesus. And in Ephesus, there was a great riot that took place. And on that occasion, back in Acts chapter 19, there were two of Paul's travel companions that these frenzied Jews seized, grabbed a hold of, and no doubt took and interrogated and beat them. One of them was Aristarchus. He's still with him. You know, if you had experienced those kind of things back in Ephesus with Paul, once you finish that journey, wouldn't you say, hey, you know, this has been great. Nice knowing you. You know, this has been such an experience, but I've got things to do. Why would you be with him? Why would you stay with him? Why would you get on a boat with this guy if you had already experienced that? But he's got two of his friends. He's got Luke. He has Aristarchus with him. And they have been delivered, verse 1 says, they have been delivered into the custody of a centurion named Julius. He's an important character in this chapter. This centurion Julius, this Roman official who would have at one time had charge of 100 soldiers, is now in charge of Paul and the other prisoners. Paul is not the only prisoner, verse 1 says. There are some other prisoners. They embark on a ship in verse 2, and they leave Caesarea, and they go north. They go north along the Mediterranean. Verse 3 says they get to the city of Sidon, and when they got there, they ported at the city. And it's interesting that Julius, verse 3 says, treated Paul kindly, gave him liberty to go to his friends and receive care. Now they got to port, and here's a prisoner. Are you going to let a prisoner go free? You know, what could, if Paul had decided to bail on him, if Paul had decided to he's going to give me a little freedom, he gives me an inch, I'm going to take a mile and I'm out of here. What would have happened to Julius? If Julius had lost his charge, lost his prisoner, Julius is dead. What does this say about Julius? What does it say about his character? What does it say about his trust in Paul? If he's willing to let him go and receive care, the word that's used for care here at the end of verse 3 was oftentimes a word that was used medically in the first century. And so perhaps he was going to receive some kind of medical attention for things that he was going through. Maybe that's why Luke is with him. Maybe he's got his own personal physician. I mean, what prisoner ever travels with his own personal physician, right? Maybe that's why Luke is traveling with him. But they leave Sidon. And what happens in chapter 27, what we're going to see is that this is a very difficult voyage. They're going to have difficulties all along the way, and ultimately, you know, it's going to end in a shipwreck. But we see in verse 4, they leave Sidon, and this is a great chapter to get a Bible map out and follow along on a Bible map. And I don't know if you've got good maps in the back of your Bible. You can get maps online today, or you can buy a Bible atlas in a book form. This is a great chapter to try to follow along where this ship is going. Because what they're doing, if you know the Mediterranean in this region, there's that island called Cyprus, kind of up in the northeast sector of the Mediterranean Sea. Cyprus is where Barnabas was from. Paul had stopped there on his first missionary journey. But what you read is that this ship leaves Sidon, this little city, and because the winds were contrary, they sailed under the shelter of, verse 4 says, they sailed under the shelter of Cyprus, and then they came over the north side of the island of Cyprus, and they sailed along the southern coast of Asia Minor. Again, it's helpful to have a Bible map, and you can see where the Mediterranean Sea, there's almost that northeast section is up where the city of Antioch is, Antioch of Syria, that major missionary city. But what they have done is they're now traveling along the southern coast of the Asia Minor, up where Cilicia is. That's where Paul was from. You see, if you have a Bible map out, you might see the city of Tarsus right there in Cilicia. They pass Cilicia, they go past Pamphylia, and then they get to the city of Myra. In verse 6, they change ships. Don't know how big that first ship was, but when they get to Myra, that was perhaps the first ship's docking port, and so they weren't going to go any further. And so Julius finds another ship in verse 6. This is an Alexandrian ship. Where would an Alexandrian ship be from? Egypt. From Alexandria, Egypt. That's why it's called an Alexandrian ship. It's from Alexandria in Egypt. This would have been probably a trade ship. No doubt a trade ship that was traveling from Egypt to make its way to Rome. And as we will learn later on in this chapter, there was wheat aboard. The wheat was the last thing that they threw off of the ship. Egypt was a major source of grain. At this time, Egypt was a major source of grain for Rome. And so this ship is a trade ship traveling, taking the grain from Egypt up to Rome. Julius gets permission to take the prisoners aboard this ship to make their way to Rome. And what we'll learn over in verse 37, what we learn over in verse 37 is how many people are there on board this ship? 276 people. Why does the Bible tell us that? I mean, it's an interesting detail that God tells us. He doesn't say about 300. He doesn't say more than 200. God gets down specifically to tell us exactly how many people are on board. Now, the exact why of that is unknown. But no doubt, this is a good-sized ship. I mean, how big does a ship need to be to have 276 people on it, to have all of the cargo that obviously was on board because they kept throwing cargo overboard, a ship that had more than four anchors. How many anchors does your boat have? Here's a large ship, and these prisoners are on board. Look in verse 7. We sailed slowly many days and arrived with difficulty. And so again, this is a difficult journey. We'd ride with difficulty in Cnidus. And again, follow this along. They have followed along the southern coast of Asia Minor and to get to this little area of Cnidus. But then the wind wouldn't permit us to go any further. What would have been ideal is that they could have just kept going west. If they could have kept going west, then they would eventually have made it to Rome. But if you look at a Bible map, they couldn't keep going west. The wind was contrary, and so they actually went due south, sailed under the shelter of Crete. And again, verse 8 says that they did it with difficulty. So the winds were contrary back up in verses 4 and 5. Now they're sailing with difficulty in verses 7 and 8. And they came to a city, to a port on the southern side of Crete, and the name of it was Fair Havens. So they get to this city, they get to this port of Fair Havens, and they've arrived there with great difficulty. What would you have done if you had been on board? Now, what we have just read, what did that take us? To get from Myra to Fair Havens took us three verses. That was pretty easy reading, right? And we had with difficulty twice in there, but you didn't have any difficulty with that, right? I mean, because you're sitting on a padded pew in air conditioning, and you just had breakfast this morning. You didn't have any difficulty with that. But they cannot go where they want to go. The winds are contrary. They cannot go in the direction they want to go. Now, I know, you know, for us, we get on board and we crank up our Evinrude or we crank up our, you know, our Johnson, whatever we're going to do, we crank up 250 horsepower and we're going to go wherever we want to go. What kind of inboard or outboard motors do they have? They got wind and sails. What does that do for you? That takes you wherever the wind wants to go. And so here, they get to this southern side of Crete. And I don't know about you, but if I was on board this and I got to Fair Havens and I was finally on dry ground, I'd say, see y'all later. You know, I'm out of here. Or if I'm the captain, if I'm the leader on board this ship, I would have said, you know what, let's just stay here a little while. In fact, let's stay here a long while. Let's figure this out before we actually start moving again. And so in verse 9, what do you have at the very beginning of verse 9? New King James says, when they had spent much time there. Wouldn't you? I wouldn't be ready to go the next day. They spent a good amount, we don't know how long, but it says, when they had spent much time there, and sailing was now dangerous. Sailing was now, why was sailing now dangerous? Time of year. They're moving on towards winter, and he even tells us the time of year. Sailing was now dangerous because the fast was already over. What's the fast? You got a footnote? Okay. The fast was associated with the Jewish Day of Atonement. Jewish Day of Atonement was at the end of September or early October. You've got on your handout that the mariners, the seamen of that time, they had plotted out when are the good times to sail and when are the bad times to sail. And so they had already, for however long, determined that there were good times of year to go sailing on the open sea, and there were other times of year you don't want to be out there. And so they had marked off on their calendars, as some historians have figured out, they had marked off on their calendars that the perilous season of to be on the sea was from September 14th to November 11th. What did this verse just tell us? What time of year is it? They're at the end of September and early October. In fact, it says that the fast had already passed. So they're in October. They're in early October sometime. What is that? So that puts them right in the middle of this perilous time to be on the sea. And then any time after November and into mid-March, they wouldn't touch the open sea at all. So here they are in Fair Havens, and it's the dangerous time to be on the water. Would you have got back out on the water? So Paul says to them in verse 10, "Men, I perceive." Now it's important to see Paul saying, "I perceive." The word that's used there is the word "perceive" that's used there is a word that denotes something about past experience. Here's what I perceive based upon past experience and observation. Let me tell you some things. I've got it in your notes later on, but we have already noted that Paul wrote 2 Corinthians. Think about the book. Paul wrote 2 Corinthians back in Acts chapter 20. When Paul was in Macedonia back in Acts chapter 20, that's when he wrote 2 Corinthians. And 2 Corinthians chapter 11 is where Paul lists all of the things that he had gone through, all of the physical traumas that he had endured. One of the things he lists there is that he had been shipwrecked 3 times. Now, Paul's not, obviously, Paul's not the expert on board. Paul's not, there are other men on board this ship who are the sailors, who are the seamen, who understand the sea. But here's a guy who's been shipwrecked already in his life 3 times. When we get to the end of the chapter, he can add on number 4. This guy's been shipwrecked 4 times. You think he knows what a shipwreck's going to look like before it happens? So he says, "Here's what I perceive, all right? I'm not an expert, but I've been through this before, apparently." And he says, "I perceive that this voyage will end with disaster and much loss." Now, are they going to listen to Paul? Of course not. He's a prisoner. Worse than being a prisoner, he's a preacher. And who's going to listen to a preacher? What has he got? What does he understand, Ruth? Well, Ruth asked, was God guiding Paul at this time? It's an interesting question because I think God was guiding this whole situation. I think you've got the finger of God's providence happening all the way through this chapter. What had God promised to Paul back in chapter 23 and verse 11? "You're going to Rome. You're going to witness for me in Rome." Is that a promise? Is that going to happen? Is God going to make sure he gets there? All right. Now, it would have been nice to fly first class, wouldn't it? I mean, God, if I'm going to Rome, you know, first class would be okay. But a ship, you know, on the open sea during dangerous season, okay. But here's one other note on what Ruth's asking. Was God guiding Paul? Were these God's words? Paul says, "I perceive," in verse 10, "that this voyage will end with much disaster and much loss, not only of the cargo and the ship, but also of our lives." Did this voyage end with loss of life? Not a single one. Wasn't a single life lost on this voyage. Was God telling Paul to say that? Or was Paul saying, "You know, guys, I've kind of been through this before, and here's what I think might be happening here." We'll note that again. I'll try to remember to note that again when we get down here later on. What does verse 11 say? "The centurion was more persuaded by the pilot, the helmsman, and the captain or the owner of the ship than he was by the things of Paul. And because the harbor that they were in, the Fair Havens Harbor, was not suitable to winter in. That's hard for us to even fathom in South Florida. What does it mean? It's not a good place to winter in. We live in a place that's good to winter in all the time. The harbor, Fair Havens, was not a suitable wintering harbor. And so the majority, they always win, right? The majority advised to set sail, to put to sea, most translations say, from there also, if by any means they could reach Phoenix, not Arizona, a harbor of Crete opening toward the south and northwest, and winter there. Phoenix was a winter harbor. And it's only 40 miles away. That's not very far, right? They had already traveled hundreds of miles. And it's not only just 40 miles away, but it's on the same island. It's on the same side of the island. So all they have to do is get back on the boat and hug the shoreline for 40 miles. They get to Phoenix, and there they can stay. Sounds simple, right? How's that going to work out for them? Probably should have listened to what Paul said. So, verse 13. It doesn't take much to please men, does it? Here in verse 13, they get a little soft wind from the south, and they think, this is the sign we've been waiting for. A light wind from the south, it's perfect for us. Let's hit the sea. And so they do. They put to sea, and they tried to stay close to Crete, verse 13 says. What's the first word you have in verse 14? That's not going to be good, right? They tried to stay close to Crete, tried to hug the shoreline, but not long after, a tempestuous headwind. Anybody have a different word than that? A tempestuous headwind. A nor'easter. Where would a nor'easter come from? It's going to come from the north. Remember, they're on the south coast of Crete. Crete is a mountainous island. And a tempestuous, the word for tempestuous there is the Greek word typhonikos. We get the word typhoon from it. So from the mountains of Crete, there's a nor'easter that comes from the north. A typhoon comes upon them. That kind of makes the word but at the beginning pretty accurate, doesn't it? Not long after, a typhoon, a nor'easter headwind, arose, and they had a name for it. We name our storms, right? If they get up to, 74, 75 miles an hour, we give them a name, all right? This typhoon had the same name all the time. They didn't go alphabetically. He just had a name, and it was always that name. Here comes Yurtakilo. They knew exactly what was happening. Here's these sailors. Think they'd heard about this? Yeah, it's got a name. All right, you think they'd experienced it? Here comes Yurtakilo, drives them south from the mainland of Crete. So when the ship was caught in the wind, verse 15, they could not head into the wind. They had no choice, the end of the verse. They had to be driven by the wind. And so they ran under the shelter of a smaller island. If you've got a Bible map, and you look at the city, the island of Crete, there is a little dot of an island just south of Crete called Calda. And so they sailed under the shelter of this little baby island, Calda. And the end of verse 16 says they secured the skiff, basically a smaller boat that had been in tow. We might call it a dinghy. So here's a large ship. There's a little boat, there's a skiff, and they secured it. The end of verse 16 says, how did they secure it? With difficulty. This is a hard deal. We've read about this difficulty they're having multiple times already. And so they secured the boat, they took it on board, verse 17 says, and then they not only secured the dinghy, but they used cables to undergird the ship, fearing lest they should run aground on the citrus sands. They set sail, they struck sail, they let down their sea anchor, depending on what translation you have, and they let themselves be driven. I want you to put yourself in their situation. They have now been driven from the land that they were trying to hug and stay near by this typhoon. They've been driven out to open sea. their lifeboat, their skiff has become dislodged. Now they've had to secure it. Not only are they concerned about the little boat, they're concerned about their boat, their ship that they're on. They're concerned about it falling apart. And so they take these ropes and these cables and they wrap them around the hull of the ship. I'm certain you've never done that, right? I mean, what are they? They're concerned about this thing falling apart. And so they are strapping these cables, these ropes around the hull to keep it from falling apart. And what they're worried about, this Syrtis Sands, you'll have to go and research it, but this Syrtis Sands, they weren't even close to it. This is way off south of Sicily, north between Sicily and Libya, the northern coast of Africa, and Tunisia. If you go right there, right over there is where the Syrtis Sands are. They're hundreds of miles away from that. But they're concerned about what's going to happen to them even sometime down the road in all of this storm. And so verse 18 says, because we were exceedingly tempest-tossed. That's saying it lightly, huh? Because we were exceedingly tempest-tossed. You think Luke and Aristarchus are rethinking this now? I mean, Paul's got to be there, right? Paul's the prisoner. He's the one who appealed to Caesar. Let Paul go to Caesar, fine. We're going to stay here and go to Starbucks. You know, we're going to stay. Forget getting on this boat. You think when Luke uses the word we in verse 18, you think he's rethinking whether he should be there or not? We were exceedingly tempest-tossed, and so the next day they lightened the ship. Some translations say they jettisoned the cargo. Can you picture that? We don't need this. Get rid of it. Why would they be lightening the ship? Why do you lighten a ship? Floats better, Dan? Yeah. That's interesting. As Dan said, obviously these are wooden ships, and so one of the reasons they would need to tighten or to secure the hull is because you've got water coming in, and they're trying to tighten some of their main gear there, and so obviously they are trying to lighten the ship. One, to keep it floating. Two, if they're concerned about running aground on these Syrtis Sands, which are hundreds of miles away, but if they're concerned about running aground, you know, they want to be they don't want to be as down in the water as they were. And so 19, the third day, verse 19, the third day, they're not done. It's interesting, and I don't know that there's any significance to this, but the pronoun in verse 18 is they lightened the ship. The pronoun in verse 20 is we. It's almost like, all right, guys, we all got to get involved in this. So I don't know if there's any significance to the change in pronouns. But we threw the ship's tackle, the equipment, the furniture, everything that we threw it overboard with our own hands. We're getting rid of this stuff. Now verse 20. Now when neither sun nor stars appeared for many days. Is that a bad thing? That's a bad thing for a lot of reasons, right? It's not just that you can't see the stars at night. It's that you can't see the sun in the day. They have no idea where they are. They didn't have GPS, all right? They didn't have radios. They got to look up to be able to know where they are. And when you can't see the sky, you don't have a clue. So you're not only exceedingly tempest-tossed, you're not only being thrown all over the place, not only within your ship, but all over the sea. Are you kidding me? Where'd the time go? All right. They didn't have any idea where they were. No small tempest beat upon us. So the end of verse 20 says, all hope that we would be saved was given up. They had been hanging on to hope that they'd be saved, but finally, there's no more hope that we are going to be saved. So what does Paul do? Paul stands up and basically says to them in verse 21, he says, okay, I don't know that verse 21 is an I told you so. We would read it that way. You know, Paul says, should listen to me, told you not to do this. I don't know that that's the case, because what he is doing, and this comes back to what Ruth mentioned, what he is doing is saying, now let me tell you what God says. Okay? Maybe you should have listened to me before. Let me tell you what God says. Now, here he is on this boat that's being tossed around, and he says in verse 22, there will be no loss of life among you. Wait a minute. Earlier, he thought that there would be, and that's why I think the earlier comment was Paul's own perception about what was happening. Now he's saying there will be no loss of life. Well, Paul, how do you know there's not going to be any loss of life? Because, verse 23, there stood by me this night in the midst of this tempestuous sea and this rocking boat, there was an angel standing beside me. And what did the angel of God say? The angel of God said, do not be afraid. You must be brought before Caesar. And indeed, God has granted you all those who sail with you. And so Paul stands up and he says, guys, we are going to be saved. The God to whom I belong, the God whom I serve, and the God whom I believe has told me that we're all going to be saved, that not a single life is going to be lost. And so he says in verse 25, I believe God that it will be just as he told me. However, we must run aground on a certain island. And we'll know that island later to be named Malta. And so Paul gets up and Paul says, guys, you need to take heart and you need to trust that God is going to get us out of this situation. And so then they go another period of nights. This wasn't over yet. And so you get down to verse 27, the 14th night. How many days could you have dealt with this? 2 weeks, 14 nights, they are being tossed to and fro, verse 27 says, all over the sea. However, they thought that they were approaching land, and so they started taking soundings, which is an interesting thing to see how they did it then. We don't have time to describe it, but they recognized that they were coming closer to land and closer to land. So they dropped, verse 29, they dropped 4 anchors from the stern to try to slow their progress, stabilize the direction that they were going. And the end of verse 29 says they prayed for day to come. You ever done that? You ever been so horrible in life? You just prayed that the sun would rise. The sailors tried to escape. The sailors tried to escape. You'll notice that down in verse 32, it's the soldiers who cut the ropes. The sailors tried to lower the lifeboat to get out. And verse 32 says the soldiers came along and cut the ropes. And the reason the soldiers came along and cut the ropes is because of what Paul says in verse 31. Paul said in verse 31, unless these guys stay on board, we cannot be saved. Are God's promises of salvation conditional? That's what you got on the back of your handout. Here's a promise, it's conditional. Unless these men stay on board, we cannot be saved. Didn't Jesus say, unless a man is born of water, he cannot enter the kingdom of God? That's God's stipulations. Those are God's conditions on salvation. And so you get to the end of the chapter. We won't have time to investigate all of this. You get to the end of the chapter, and they did follow God's plan. The last sentence of the chapter says, everybody was saved. They were not saved because of their own goodness. They were saved because of God, and they were saved because they happened to be on a ship with the Apostle Paul, whom God was protecting to get to the city of Rome. You know, sometimes non-Christians are blessed just by being around Christians. And that's what happened here in Acts chapter 27. Read this chapter. Follow it. Use your handout to get some of the details that perhaps would help you to go through this. Fascinating chapter about how God's providence saw these people through on this very difficult time. Thank you for your good attention this morning.